Yeah, I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just catapulting towards some greater purpose?
Cats with bloated ego. We are the only DJ crazy enough to tattoo Jackie Brown on his ass.
This is Michael Mann, and I ride with
extended clip.
Zoom is a sync, so we don't have to do any of that, you know, clap track kind of thing, which I often find embarrassing. I like to pretend I'm above other podcasters because I don't need clap. A clap track. But a clap is fun. A clap is communal, and a clap is musical, and I guess that's why people do it. So maybe I'm just the no fun guy, you know?
I'm with you. I don't even like using it in a movie set, so I'm with you.
It's too aggressive.
Welcome to Extended Clip. It is episode 293. I am one of your hosts, Eddie Averill.
I'm Malcolm Baum.
I'm JT White.
And, you know, we've had this guy on for the man of the hour, the special guest, the guest of honor a few times. So today he's going to be kind of a co-host as well on the fourth mic of the show. Will Sloan is back, everybody.
Thank you. Any chance to be here with Matt, you know, it's hard to get access to him these days after his Blockbuster Times profile.
Well, as a producer, I'm going to cut in right now, say I was saving the guest intro. In my pre-show notes I sent over, we were going to reveal the guest as a surprise. It was going to be, you know, we hadn't said anything, but hey, it's Matt Farley's the guest. Matt Farley's the guest here.
Yeah, and the coup de chance episode was great, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. We are very glad to have the man of recent legend in the paper of record, and also the man we've talked up on this damn podcast for since, what, 2018 or so, when we talked about local legends, and it's finally a long time coming. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is cool, and I'm a fan of the show.
Thank you. That means a lot. I wanted to start with a question about Boston Johnny. Yeah. Was this your first film that you conceived, like, character first, and even more than that, was it your first film you conceived with a silly voice beyond anything else?
Yeah. And I've gone on record as saying, never again. You're never going to hear that Boston Johnny voice out of me ever again. I'm shocked by the almost unanimously positive reviews. I can't even watch it. I'm like, who? Why didn't someone say something? You know, is when I watch it. One of my favorite parts, though, is at least I love the inconsistencies of the Boston Johnny voice, because there are whole chunks of the movie where it's like a different voice, and it's just because I'm bad at, like, if I had tried to be inconsistent, that's no fun. But if it just happened, then it is fun. So it's okay.
I like that it's not a Boston accent, you would think, given the title.
Yeah. We got away with it somehow. But I was on my podcast, I was joking that, like, if we did a sequel, I wouldn't want to do the voice. And so the movie would just start with me kind of clearing my throat and then being like, ah, there we go. And then I just talk normal for the movie.
Where did the voice come from? Were you just walking around the house doing a silly voice, or what?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a variation on, like, the voice that sometimes I would fall into while I was recording my songs, you know.
Sure,
like,
yeah,
I just kind of, like, into this, like, weird loungy lounge act kind of guy, and so yeah, that's where it came from.
Do you remember what the conception of the movie was? Like, obviously it was established, it was sort of voice first, but, like, when you were coming, because the pitch of the movie, I guess, is basically something like, what if there was an SNL movie, but the SNL character never existed? Like, do you remember, like, was it that, or what exactly was the idea?
The exact idea is Charlie loves, like the found footage festival, and, stuff like that, and he was just talking about, like, some set of clips of, like, people struggling to get through corporate videos.
Oh, like the Winnebago Man or something like that.
Yeah, like that, but probably even more specific and obscure. And he was like, it would be fun if we did that, you know? And then I was like, yeah, and I'll talk in like that weird voice that I use when I song sometimes. And then it just went from there. So we, like, the opening scene was always going to be exactly what it was going to be. And then it was just like, all right, now what? And it went in many directions.
I feel like throughout your movies, you've had people have local access shows and different kind of TV shows and stuff like that. And I think Pippi's Decision is, you know, my favorite thing that's been broadcast in the Moturn Mediaverse. But is there something that, like, influenced you, or where did the idea of having the characters in your movies have their own talk shows and shows like that come about?
So I think it's a good, like, plot device, you know, good way to just kind of, like, get information to the other characters sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then another thing we frequently say is, like, we wish we lived in a world where everyone watched public access, and that's like what everyone was talking about. Wouldn't that be so great? Or if there was a local paper where the journalist was raking up muck, you know? So we just want to create a world that we wished we lived in, you know, a place where cars were banned from downtown, et cetera, et cetera.
Were there specific public access shows that meant a lot to you growing up?
Well, first off, Charlie had his own public access show when he was in high school. And so that's big in his world for sure. And then you know, my touchstone is Zones of Evil in the town where I grew up, which, you know, the guy Brian Fortin, who hosted it, is like an all-time legend in my community, and he acts in our movies, which is the best.
Speaking of that, was there anyone that is in your kind of acting repertory company that was hard to convince on the whole thing? Like, was it hard to convince Kevin McGee to be in your movies, or was he just open to the concept right away? Because, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people say that, but he's my favorite character in the universe of your movies, or my favorite actor, at least.
Right. I mean, if someone's hard to convince, we just won't work with them, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it needs, like, you can feel it when someone doesn't want to be there, and it's like, and then, like, we're nervous as it is, and then add to the fact that so-and-so's not into it, like, you know, we're out. I mean, so that's that. I mean, the only other thing we have to deal with is just people's schedules and whatnot.
Yeah.
Like, people want to do it, but they're busy. They don't want to say no to us, but they also can only spare a certain amount of time. And so it's a delicate situation where I try to be like, hey, look, you're not going to hurt my feelings if you can't do it. It's okay. We can give you a smaller role if you can't do the big role. Like, our emotional well-being is more important than who plays what role in a movie.
I bet there's been some people who kind of regretted saying no at the beginning, and they kind of see all the fun that's being had on screen. You know, there's probably some people who kind of wish they got on board. You'd have to.
Yeah, imagine. There's one guy for Manch Vegas. Some guy I hardly knew, but he had charisma, and I was like, he'd be good in the movie, and he agreed to be in Manch Vegas. But then, as the date came up, there was a cookout that he wanted to go to, and I was just like, you're going to go to another, like, how many cookouts are you going to this summer? You're going to another cookout as opposed to being in a movie that will be discussed on podcasts for decades to come, you know?
Sort of just spinning off of that, because I remember, like, in reading Will's book about your production process, you talking about trying to get people in and out, like, actors as quickly as possible in that sense. What is, like, an average day on, like, production look like? What are the hours like? What's the atmosphere on set?
You know, for the last few years, usually I'll show up. Like, Charlie and I live almost 3 hours from each other. So one of us is up at 5 a.m. driving to the other guy's house. So, and then the other guy is probably just awake and like rocking back and forth in anticipation waiting for it. So that's what it's like beforehand. Or, you know, if we're filming here, Charlie's driving up while I'm just getting all the equipment, checking the batteries for the 15th time, making sure we have all the wires and just being completely paranoid. It's, you know, because like if we're going to a place even 15 minutes away, if we get there and then we realize we forgot something, it means drive another 15 minutes, get the thing, drive back, boom, we're a half hour in the hole already. So it's like just being crazy about that. And then, you know, like for the Hurt She Got Murdered movie, like there was a weekend we had Jay Mayo the whole weekend. He was only there for the movie. And so he, you know, he was with us all day and just, all right, Mayo, 8 a.m., meet us at this park. And Charlie, I, and Mayo converged on this park. We filmed for 2 hours. We went to a different park by Fortin's house, filmed for 40 minutes. We came home, filmed in the garage for several hours, then filmed in the backyard with T-Max and Toomey. And then went to a school and filmed in the woods by the school. I was really excited about this because we needed wood scenes and we needed scenes by in the jail. And I was like, there's a school that in the back could double for the outside of a jailhouse. And there's woods there. So boom, we just saved one extra trip on the thing. And so at this point, it's like night, you know, it's nighttime. Then we come back home and film in the garage for just me, Mayo, and Charlie for another like 3 or 4 hours. And so, I mean, it's intense, you know, and prior to that, it's a lot of like just me scheduling it, you know? I mean, Woody Allen doesn't have to schedule each day of his film. Woody Allen shows up and they're like, we're doing these scenes. He's like, okay, you know, but, I'm literally checking the battery levels, making sure we have the mics, setting up the mics before filming the scene. Charlie's got like all these wires all over him because he's the sound man and he's the cameraman and he's directing the actors and sometimes he's in the scenes too. So so it's total chaos.
Has the chaos like subsumed a little bit over the years, or does it seem to get more chaotic with the more ambitious films?
I think we keep getting better and better. I think we keep getting better and better at knowing what to do. And I mean, for the last batch of films, it's been a little bit tighter in terms of the amount of characters and whatnot. But that's all going to change. Evil Puddle has it's like a disaster movie where you're cutting to one group of people dealing with their evil puddle, another group of people dealing with their evil puddle.
Oh, nice.
There's like five plot lines, all you know, like a 1970s disaster movie. And in each one, there's at least, you know, 4 to 10 characters. So we're in for it. But like we've been living too easy a life for a few years. We got to make it hard again.
Well, the recent movies, you seem to have hit upon this idea of having scenes that have 2 or 3 people in them, and then those 2 or 3 people will appear in like 3 or 4 scenes throughout the movie, you know, beginning, middle, and end. And it cycles back and forth between these characters, sort of giving the sense that they're in there all the way through. But it looks like you've actually devised a shooting model where people only have to show up for like one day or one afternoon or I don't know, maybe even 1 hour and get it all done.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially for Sharon's roles in Hurt She Got Murdered. She gave us 2 days, but it was basically like 90 minutes each day. And, there, you know, I don't want to get too into it, but there's different versions of that movie. In the Tubi version that's coming out, it's just so funny the way that her character gets killed at the end, and it was totally improvised on the set, and just out of desperation, she's like, "I need to leave in 7 minutes," and we're like, "All right, quick, you do that, and we're done." And it's so funny, like we have literally no extra seconds worth of footage that we could have possibly used. Yeah, but so yeah, it's and I mean we do all the tricks in the book, like the scenes in that movie where I'm performing at the club, you know, some people were there on some days, other people were there on other days, and I think we do a pretty good job of making it look like everyone was there together. And so that's, you know, and Charlie's real good at that, and he can, like, he keeps track of, like, the geography of the scenes and whatnot.
Yeah.
And there's, if we can just find these little moments where one character connects another character, like I'm talking to one person, then I turn around and walk and talk to another person, the viewer is not going to realize those are two separate days and those other two people were never in the same room together.
I think that's a sell for getting potential actors. Like, we get you in and out quick, you know.
True.
What I mean? Like,
yeah,
this is, we value your time, you know. Clint Eastwood, Woody, they have a reputation for that. 6 hour days, how about a 7 minute day, you know? That's even better.
yeah and I definitely, the Clint approach seems really good to me, and like you know, I'm definitely not, I'm not a perfectionist by any means, and I don't necessarily think it's going to be better the more we do it.
To what extent does the, like, fact that these movies have fans and kind of have some Letterboxd popularity, to what extent have the actors got wind of that, and to what extent do they care about it?
I would say most of the actors don't know what Letterboxd is, the very high percentage.
Or let's rephrase, people outside your immediate circle, okay, are seeing, yeah, the movies.
Yeah. But it, I mean, they know to some degree. Like Sharon, I mean, Sharon's been in every one of the movies since Freaky Farley, and she's pretty laid back about it, just like whatever. It's,
well, as long as you shoot all the scenes at once, you know.
she's super nice, honestly. She'd, yeah, come more frequently too. It's just like we don't want to bother her too much.
No, I get it. That's what they had to do with Fred McMurray and My Three Sons. They would shoot like him coming down the staircase talking to the three sons, like the whole season's worth in a day, you know.
And are they aware of their popularity? I mean, McGee noticed that someone got a tattoo of his face. So,
I didn't know about that. That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was revealed at the last extravaganza, and McGee's wife was just blown away. She's like, "Oh my god, I'm not gonna be able to live with this guy anymore now that he knows a fan has a tattoo." So yeah, he's aware, and like, but it's hard, like. It's hard for him to like explain it to his friends and family, you know. And he's like, if he tries, he's like, you know, I'm kind of a big deal in the ultra indie film circuit, and like people just are like, what are you talking about? We don't, yeah, even know. They're sure you are, you know.
Yeah, trust me though. Like, I know it's nobody you know, but the 150 people who listen to this podcast by three guys in LA, they love me, you know. Yeah. Well, it's a hard thing to explain.
I went to the extravaganza last year, and when Kevin McGee showed up, and he had was full like Frank Sinatra vibes, where like he was the only one who said he rolled in 15 minutes before his appearance, shook, nice, hands, sang, stayed 15 minutes after, and then left.
Yeah, that's
chairman
great
of the board. And like, I wish people could experience the vibe in the room during that moment, because it was as if Taylor Swift came in, you know, like in that one room on that one day to those 130 people, it was like the biggest star in the world.
Speaking, yeah, of Kevin McGee and something we were talking about with like the continuity in shooting, was it hard to shoot the statue scene in River Beast? Because it's a lot of like people talking in that auditorium for a while, or wherever that hall was in the end of River Beast, where he is a statue, and it's probably my favorite scene of any of your movies. Was that difficult to pull off on set, or like what was going on that day?
I don't know. Basically, I mean, I was kind of focused on just being in front of the camera, and yeah, Charlie was behind the camera, so it seemed like a pretty smooth operation as far as I could tell. McGee is like, he's like an athlete, you know, he's a bodybuilder, yeah. He's a performer, and so if you challenge him to do something difficult, like he's just like, all right, bring. I mean, like,
nice.
He'll go. And for family vacations, he wants to go to places where they have like competitive sports at like a resort with competitive sports, so he can dominate over other vacationers the whole week, you know. So who knows, if they had a standstill contest at one of these resorts, he would absolutely crush.
That's great. I could absolutely see him doing that.
I didn't know that these resorts, I need to get in on these sports resorts where you could play with other people. Mickey might be onto something there.
I do remember once as a kid going on a vacation with my dad, and there was this little like rec room with the ping pong table. And I was so mad that I couldn't just like run the ping pong table. Like I lost pretty early on, and I was like, man, it would have been so cool to just be like the guy at the ping. And I was like 10 yeah. too, so I would have been like beating all
McGee,
these high school.
McGee would have had no mercy. He'd have no mercy on you if he was playing against you.
It would have been like that scene in Goodbye Columbus, just a grown man beating on a kid at ping pong, which yeah. is a great scene. That's one of the funniest scenes ever written. So. Back to Heard She Got Murdered, you referenced the Tubi cut. How many cuts are there?
There are 4 cuts. The screener, like in-person screener, that's in black and white. No, that's in color. The Blu-ray is in black and white, I think. Yeah, the Vimeo version's back to color, and then Tubi is back to black and white. And Tubi version is about 20 minutes shorter than the other three.
So where did you conceive this idea? Like, is this the first time you've done multiple cuts of a movie?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I have, like a reverence for, like, Halloween and Halloween 2. And, like, the fact that when they were... I think it was when they were filming Halloween 2, they filmed an extra scene for the TV version of Halloween where the girls just kind of, like, gossip with each other in the house yeah. for a few minutes. And then it's like, ooh, like the... The secret yeah. TV scene, you know, and then Halloween, Halloween 2 has stuff that was only for the TV version also. And then I was like, Charlie, I have an idea, 4 versions. And he was like, ooh, wow, that sounds like a lot of work. I was like, I'll edit all 4. Don't worry about it. You know? And then it was, the script was written at that point. Then I went back and just added like, you know, scene 5. A, scene 5B, scene 5C, you know? And basically, if someone, if somebody did 2 takes, I'd use both, you know? Okay, take yeah. the first take we'll use in version 2 and 4, the second take we'll use in 1 and 3. It's almost imperceptibly different, you know, but still, like, the dream is that someone doesn't know it's coming and is watching it and just has an uneasy feeling, like, why does this seem different than the movie I remember, you know?
A lot of your, I would say your recent films have formed something of a phase or something, a group of films. I specifically remember Heard She Got Married and Metal Detector Maniac and Magic Spot. I remember those 3 feeling like 3 of one piece. And do you consciously try to go through like phases, or are you aware of going through kind of phases in your filmmaking, or is it just like what you feel in the moment is gonna be what you make?
Yeah, it's mostly what we feel is right, and kind of like as we're making a movie, we always have like a few options of what we're gonna do yeah. next, you know, and we might think, oh, we're doing such and such a movie next, but then as we're in the midst of the current movie, we're like, yeah, you know what, we got to go in a different direction just to switch things up. That being said, we were aware that there was a different feeling and vibe to those movies, you know, the black and white and more minimalism involved in it and bleakness, you know. Mm. There's a certain bleakness to the locations, a lot of winter shots, you know. And so, yeah, we were aware, but the only time I think explicitly about things is just like, oh, this will annoy our fans, like this, I can't wait to try this.
This is something I respect about your recent run of movies, because like after Slingshot Cops, when like some people started to discover the movies, it would have been very easy, or like the cynical move would have been to try to reverse engineer another River Beast and, yeah. you know, maybe get it into some of those festivals that turned it down, you know, the first time. But you went the exact opposite approach.
Yeah, yeah. We're probably not going to... We're not making money off these movies still. And even if we tried to do something that we thought would catch on, probably still not going to make money. River Beast still isn't making money for us. So it's like, let's just be, instead of trying to chase what might quote unquote work commercially, let's do all the what we wish like our coolest, all our favorite directors would do, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. So so it's great. It's a great freedom to have. We have nobody to answer to. And we just do it. I mean, the fact that I Heard You Got Married is our most sincere and like thoughtful analysis of like failure as an artist and like dealing with the fact that the people you used to be creative with aren't into it anymore, you know. And then the sequel is like essentially like the Rambo 3 situation, where like the first Rambo movie is a relatively like thoughtful piece about you know, a Vietnam vet, right, dealing with being home, and then by Rambo 3 he's all greased up, you know. Yeah. and so that's what we were like, oh, imagine if we grease up Mitch Owens for, so, you know, metaphorically.
Yeah, I would like to see what your Death Wish 3 would be like. the giggler.
I love that. I love how, like, when things go off the rails, you know, yeah. when they jump the shark and whatnot, it's so hilarious. And I love to have, like, lofty, creative, like, high-minded creative loftiness be completely undermined by, mm-hmm. like, crass commercialism. That's poetry.
It's true. you had accepted, you know, not making money on these movies right now, but are you paying attention to like which movies seem to get more views? Like, are you aware of which ones are more successful relative to the other ones?
Yeah. I mean, there's no question. River Beast is number one for sure. Okay. Leaps yeah. and bounds above the rest. And then it, you know, Local Legend seem you can kind of look at the number of views on Letterboxd, and I think that yeah. basically gives you an idea. I mean, for sure, we have way more viewers than have logged it on Letterboxd, but I think proportionally it lines up. And I haven't surrendered in terms of like actually making money off this at some point. Mm-hmm. It's a long process, and it's just like, I'm still on board of the plan is just make so many movies that they can't ignore us.
I mean, it worked for music, and it's been working for movies. Less and less people are ignoring you, I guess.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. It's just slower. Everything about making yeah. a movie, it takes way more time compared to music, and maybe people are a little bit more apt to try out a song they've never heard and listen to it for 2 minutes versus trying out a movie they've never heard of.
I kind of consider it like a personal goal. Like, by decade's end, you'll have a Criterion Channel retrospective.
Yeah.
You know, like within 5 years, you know, the Metrograph in New York will do like a full yeah. retrospective. Not yeah. that I have any sway with these institutions, but it's a yeah. personal goal to like keep mentioning these movies until like yeah. Everyone's collective efforts get them to that level.
Well, thank you. And but seriously, like the old guard is moving on, and someone's got to replace them. So like yeah. It might as well be us. And one thing that I noticed like what. Like my music has been in the ears of a generation of kids, you know, yeah. who are only now just teenagers or in their twenties. Yeah. Like I did a show on Sunday night, and people were lining up to have photos with me at this like dive bar out in the middle of nowhere in Westfield, Massachusetts. And they're like, every one of them was like, my friends and I used to listen to you when we were kids. And I'm wow. like, you're still kids. What are you talking about? And, but I came out of it feeling, I was like, oh man, this is good. There's a whole generation that I've tricked into thinking my singing voice is normal. You know, they didn't know when they were seven listening to the Poop song. They're like, I guess this is what singers sound like.
Yeah.
So look out, you know, I plan to live into my 90s and to be creative until I turn 93. So plenty of time for lots of good things to happen.
I mean, to that, I love that you have a kind of bifurcated reputation, like to literally millions of people. Yeah. Like know the poop song. And you know, there's the Times profile, which and many other profiles like it, but then there's another audience who, you know, genuinely take you and Charlie seriously as filmmakers. And I don't want to say there's no overlap in those concentric circles, but
very little though. Yeah.
So I actually want to ask about this, cause I forgot about this. My first exposure to you, Matt, was an ad on a podcast for your music as the toilet bowl cleaners. Okay. And this was probably 2012. I want to say, were you buying ad space through like
Hollywood Handbook?
Hollywood Handbook. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yes. Yes. The Hollywood Handbook's key to my origin. But yeah. what was that, process like?
They were kind of disrespectful in their ad too. Yeah. I quite remember it. So yeah, I was just like, what can I do? And I was looking, I was like, oh my God, podcast ads are cheap. It was like $20 or something.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah. So I sent it off for a few, I think I did like the Matt Bronger show too in that same batch. And I don't know, you know, I spent like $100 for a few ads. And I definitely was rubbed the wrong way, by the way. They just totally,
man, as long as I'm predicting, within 5 years, all of those L.A. comedians are going to be like, Matt Farley, we always loved him. You know, the poop song, he's a legend.
Exactly. I will be there to be like the moderator of the reunion between Sean and Hayes from Hollywood Handbook and Matt, where they make good and just sit there and listen to him sing his songs and accept the artistry,
right? And no hard feelings too. They're just doing. It's hard. Like when you see it, when you're reading an ad for the first time and it's about a poop song band, I think it's a natural inclination to kind of not be super serious about it.
They have 10 albums of poop songs. Their hits include "Poop Into a Wormhole," "The Diarrhea Bounce Back," "I Pee When I Poop, But Not the Other Way Around," and "Poop in the Urinal." So that's the only person who gave money to our show. So look up the Toilet Bowl Cleaners, which I guess is a real thing, on iTunes, Amazon, and Spotify, and that's literally the only people that gave any money to our fucking show.
For what it's worth, they did lose plenty of sponsorships for doing bad ad reads. You are not alone there, but let's not talk about a podcast from 12 years ago. Let's talk about a movie you made 12-ish years ago. I remember a while back you talked about local legends in reference to films like Francis Ha that you kind of found ingenuous or disingenuous or false about making a life as an artist. And do you still think that local legends like holds up these days to those standards? Or do you think a decade later, do you need local legends too, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'll announce. I've sort of, someone else already posted it on Letterboxd, but I am making local legends too.
That's great to hear. Okay.
Yes, I check Letterboxd constantly. The most recent review for Local Legends 2, "This might be one of the greatest movies ever made, century defining," said the most recent review, and it wasn't me using a pseudonym, I promise. and I'm not like, I'm not joking. It's true. It is century defining. And it's like, this is what being an artist in the 21st century is about. So yeah. And again, nothing against Greta Gerwig and, what is it? Noah Baumbach? Did he direct that?
Oh yeah. I wasn't trying to dig at Francis Hall.
But their movie stinks and they're terrible. No. But when I watched that movie, I was just like, is every creative person just a mess in a basket case and just miserable and lost and aimless? I'm like, I'm not. And I think I'm making some honest, compelling art right here. And I have a chip on my shoulder because I feel like people write me off because I'm such a like happy and grounded individual. Like if my official bio involved like, major like drug addictions and run-ins with the law, people would be like, "Ooh, I can hear that in his songs." And it's like, No, you can't. No, you can't. You only hear it if you want to hear it. And so my approach is to double down on not being cool in any way possible, just mm-hmm. to be like, you know what? Most of our favorite artists are not actually that cool. They literally pay a publicist to make them look cool. And yeah. That is not cool. That is so... Imagine that. Your favorite artist is paying a publicist and being like, can you make me look cool, please? He's like, ugh, gross.
Well, it's obviously true that you probably don't have like a drug and alcohol addiction, but like you obviously do have like an unquenchable appetite for something. Like you, like as well grounded as you are, you seem to have this craving for, and I say this as affectionately as possible, attention, you know, or validation of some kind that fuels you. You know, that's kind of your.
That's my drug. For sure. Yeah, I definitely like praise a lot, and at least, but it's like I try to keep it in check, and it's like. I'm very aware of my neediness and my desire for people to love my work, you know, and I try to undermine it, undercut it, or whatever the word is, in my work too, you know, and Local Legends 2 is really hammering home at the self-obsessed nature of Matt Farley and whatnot. It's called Local Legends Bloodbath, by the way.
Oh.
Yeah.
You seem pretty tickled by most of the negative feedback too, though. Like for somebody who obviously likes validation so much, you seem to have a pretty thick skin about
people
not getting
it. That's I have the, you know, my wife will often just be like how can you be so sure of yourself, you know? I like to say, like, we have no business making movies, you know, and yet we're completely certain that we should be making movies. And the negative reviews, they're always more, sadly, they're more interesting and funnier to read. And mostly it's just people not bringing any amount of an open mind to what they're viewing. And like, it's like how warped people's concept is of what is acceptable as a piece of art.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting what you're saying earlier of like, you know, kids coming to see you. I could kind of see like the youth's kind of like sense of humor kind of like being more like in tap with what you're doing, you know, compared to like some random 40-year-old dude turning on River Beach was like, this is nonsense. I have a job and a family. Yeah. Like, I need to get back to work.
and the kids grew up with YouTube and whatnot, and so they're like, they don't need, they're okay with a certain amount of amateurism or just a lack of professionalism. Like that's not going to immediately turn them off to something. So yeah, like I said, I mean, these kids are just coming of age. And they're gonna be in charge at one point, and hopefully they'll appreciate me when that time comes.
That's when the Moturn movement begins, you know, once the changing of the guards, the old execs.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah, and I mean, it's fun to be at the forefront of a revolution and to be just kind of like, you know, challenging people's views of how things ought to be. And it's amazing how entrenched it is in all of us, me included too, you know? Like I have so many of the same like biases about like what constitutes real art as the rest of us do. So it's hard for sure. So I have some pity on the poor souls who haven't realized how great I am.
A friend of mine told me that he had cast you in an upcoming film that he was making, and I was wondering what your interest was in like filmmaking outside of the Moturn world, whether it's appearing in other people's movies or eventually if a producer were to come calling and say, hey, come make a film in this city and I'll pay for it, you know, kind of thing.
So I'm open to the serendipity of people, especially people on my level asking me to be involved in their projects. There were this group of guys from Emerson College in Boston who who contacted me, and I ended up acting in several of the movies they produced while they were students there, and that was cool. And and this gig I did in Westfield, Mass, just on Sunday night, I just got a text. I didn't know who it was from, and it was 6 months ago, and someone was just like, "Will you open for my band in Massachusetts in April?" And I said, "Yeah, of course." And then I didn't hear from them again until a couple weeks ago, and I was like, when did I agree to this? But and so the, yeah, and maybe the friend of yours lives in like the Worcester area of Massachusetts, is that right, or what? Okay, yeah, and for that, I was just like, you know, make sure there's no bad words that I have to say, and I'll give you a day. And so that was my agreement for that one. And again, it's just like, yeah, this is cool and fun, and who knows what might come of any of it. And the worst case is I spend a day with some people I never met before, so...
Well, Worcester is not great, you know.
Worcester's got heart, though. It's a rough, tough town. Not too different from Manchester, New Hampshire, frankly, which I love. So, and then I don't know. It's so unlikely that a movie studio would give us any kind of money to make a movie that I don't even know. But I do like producing things at home and completely on our terms. So, you know, like Woody Allen always says, like, he just wants people to just show up with a paper bag full of cash and they hand it to him. And then a few months later, he hands them a movie. So if someone wants to get on that, that plan with us, maybe we'd consider it. But at this point, it'd be very hard to take any notes from a money person, you know, after we've been just following our own muse for so long.
Are there filmmakers, like well-known or reasonably established filmmakers, who have reached out to you and said they like what you're doing?
Only Simon Barrett.
Writer of the number one movie in the world right now.
Oh, is it out? Oh, okay. Yeah, nice. Yeah. That's great. Good for him. He's incredibly nice, and he was watching it in that spectacle film online whatever thing that they did with us back in 2020. And so yeah, he gave us $400 to be an executive producer of Heard She Got Murdered. And it's cool. I don't know. I haven't even checked if his IMDb page includes Heard She Got Murdered, but that's so generous and so nice, and I can't thank him enough. I don't think anyone else has acknowledged us, but
some future filmmakers.
Yeah.
I did want to ask, where did the stipulation for no bad language come from?
Well, when I was in fifth grade, all my friends started saying bad words, you know?
Yeah.
And no one had said bad words prior to that. And classic. It just seemed, like... it was like, what do you do? Oh, you're cool now? Oh, you know, that's how I felt about it. And then they're like, why won't you say bad words? You should say bad words. And then I was like, well, I mean, no, absolutely not. I will not say bad words now or ever. And in high school, at one point, there was $65 on the cafeteria table that had been piled up if I would just say one bad word. And I just sat there and I shook my head.
Oh, that's like silence.
So it's completely just out of spite is the whole point. Like, I don't have any problem with bad words at all. And I just can't let my friends win.
That's the same brain that writes 25,000 songs, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's great because it does feel like I come into Moturn Films with a set of expectations where, like, the mildest damn in, like, a Hollywood movie that wouldn't, like, shock me. It's scandalous. Like, there are some times when, like, either subject matter or, like, the, I don't know, verging into a bad word comes as a deep surprise.
Or the nude photos that are referenced in Heard She Got Married.
Exactly. Yeah. That was like,
it
whoa.
Feels really slimy when I say the word nude. You know?
I mean, he took his darn shirt off in Busted Johnny. And I also think that makes, it does help with comedy, though. Like, that's always been funny to me, was like shows where they had to avoid cursing always made it so much funnier to me when I was growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Seinfeld also, of course, you know, I'm a huge Seinfeld fan, And the fact that they had to hold back, you know, meant that they had to get around things in clever ways that just made it more fun.
And that was just like, that's the hard mode version, because every other Seinfeld episode is about sex, you know?
Yeah.
And so making that without any cuss words is just, what an achievement that was.
Another thing is like when it's an unprofessional movie, like what we do, a homemade movie, it just like it does feel like, even if we weren't as prudish as we are, it does feel weird and icky when you're just like, oh, that's not an actor or an actress getting paid money for, you know, for doing this. Yeah. This is just like, you know, and
just
like
asking your mom to curse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like nude scenes.
All those Joe Swanberg movies. Yeah.
Don Dohler's, one of Don Dohler's movies. It's just like his aunt's, I say aunt, but his aunt's hairdresser that they somehow convinced to come and do a topless scene. And it's just like,
God.
Oh, this poor woman.
I guess we can get my aunt's hairdresser. What a horrible situation. Like, when you find yourself in that situation, you got to rewrite the scene or reblock the coverage, you know?
Seriously.
Like, it takes a special type of charisma, though. Like, if that person took that power and applied it to more wholesome things, like, they could be pretty far in life, because, like,
you could probably get some good donations on the street if you could get your aunt's hairdresser to appear nude in your low budget movie. You could just get donations for the money for the movie. Yeah.
And I should say too, like, you know, in Freaky Farley, there's more violence, it's a little darker, and you know, there's a simulated skinny dipping scene, and so, and part of it was, I think we say this in the book that Will and Justin did. Part of it is like, where the premiere was mostly just like our parents, you know, and like aunts and uncles and cousins, and you know, those scenes didn't get a huge reaction, you know, from that crowd, and just kind of embarrassing, you know. So that's another reason why we steer away from there. But it would be fun to do like a shockingly raunchy movie at some point. That would be great.
It also does add a lot of what I was talking about as an achievement with Seinfeld. The fact that you've made several fecal albums that do not include the S word is, you know, the amount of workarounds, the amount of types of words you have to come up with to say poo without saying S is, you know, it's hard. It's a feat for sure.
Thank you.
When the diarrhea shoots fast from your butt, once it hits the toilet, it bounces back up and it stains the bottom of your toilet seat, and it also stains your butt cheek. It's called the diarrhea bounce back, bounce back. It's called the diarrhea bounce back, baby. It's called.
Speaking of songs, I wanted to ask some music questions. I wanted to ask about Jonathan Richman. I know that you're a fan of him. What does he mean to you in terms of like both the ideas of your music and just like how it sounds and how you approach music? I'm wearing a Jonathan Richman shirt right now, if you couldn't
tell.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he's great. I brought my kids to a concert back in October.
Oh, that's great.
And like, this is their first concert. You know, they're just 7 and 9 years old, and it's like a great first concert, not too loud and nice and wholesome, and it was great. So it's kind of cool. The way I learned about him is my dad actually played one of my songs to one of his colleagues, and the colleague was like, that reminds me of Jonathan Richman. And so my dad passed that on to me, and I had never heard of him at that point. And then I looked him up, and I was like, oh, my God, this guy's amazing. And so, yeah, I'm just a huge fan of the raw love of everything. You know, like one of his songs is The World Was Showing Its Hand, you know, where he talks about how cool like an alleyway is and like the smell of exhaust from a car or from a bus or whatever. And just, yeah, I mean, his band was called the Modern Lovers, which I think kind of meant like they love all these modern inventions, kind of. I could be wrong in my interpretation of it, but just like, you know, embracing everything about life. And so I love that. And then, I mean, he's got a lot of very specific songs like Ice Cream Man.
Yes.
Which is just singing about the ice cream man. And so that's very much up my alley.
Ice Cream Man is the song I was thinking of, thinking about you, because I just recently got that Modern Lovers Live record from the late 70s where that crowd seems like they don't know what they're going to get. And they're expecting that first Modern Lovers record, that proto-punk sound. And instead they get him singing Ice Cream Man with four false endings, you know? And it's it reminds me so much of your sense of humor in your movies, even his music.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's from the Boston area too. Yeah. So there's something in the water. Cause it's so fun.
You like the Ice Cream Man? See, Ice Cream Man, ice I want you to man. Ring your bell. Ding, ding. We're talking about something.
Are you also, I also see the influence, but don't have confirmation, I guess. Are you also a fan of Robert Pollard and Guided by Voices? Because that seemed like the closest analog to the, I guess, non-joke songs you were doing in the era of Heard She Got Married and stuff like that, for my ears at least.
Yeah. I don't listen to them very much. I like them and respect them and am filled with rage whenever his name is just comes up with the word prolific, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, why is he always the one that people reference for prolific songwriters? It's like, this drives me crazy. And so, yeah, I'm jealous. And maybe the music's just a tad bit harder and noisier than is my taste, you know, where Jonathan Richman is more apt to use an acoustic guitar, Guided by Voices is more apt to use an electric guitar. And so, yeah, but I mean, hats off to, you know, just some guy from Cleveland or something. Mm-hmm. I think he's from Cleveland, Ohio, or somewhere in that general area, and just like putting out albums. And he was doing it in the 80s into the 90s where, you know, it's that much harder to get yourself out there, you know, selling CDs out of the trunk of your car or whatever. I'm very lucky to live now, you know, like I was able to put music on iTunes, you know, a few years after graduating college. I mean, if that was 10 years later, then I might not have done any of this.
What's the first album you ever put online for the world to hear?
It was called Out with the Old by Mos Haven. And, so that was in 04. Prior to 04, Tom and I, from Tom Scalzo of Mos Haven, he and I had, we had recorded like at least 1,000 songs together in the previous 5 years. And we would just put them on CDs and just each have a copy, you know, and like that was it. And like we had done a 24-hour album in 02. Where just our goal was like by the end of the year, we have to have 24 discs, each with an hour of music on it. And then we'll have a listening party. Very poorly attended, by the way. And then in 04, when I realized that anyone could put their music on iTunes, then I just started like sorting through all those songs we'd done and just putting albums together. So over the next 2 years, well, in 04, 05, I put out 10 Mos Haven albums, which were just each one was just a collection of songs that seemed to fit together from all that junk that we had done in the previous 5 years.
Any chance we might get the complete Mos Haven one day, you know, all hundreds of hours of those music?
Yeah. Well, I mean, then in 06, we did 30 minutes of music for every day of the year. There's a few thousand unreleased tracks, when you add all those projects up. And the answer is no way. I mean, a lot of it is, there was one day when I was like, well, I got to do an album today, but I got nothing. And I literally played a Nintendo video game and just did the play-by-play into the microphone. It was like a baseball game. And 30 minutes of me doing play-by-play of a video game. And I was like, that's today's album.
This is like when you do the bootleg collection, you know?
That's what I want.
Yeah.
That's what I want. I mean, if people listen to Ryan Russillo draft his fantasy team, they will listen to you narrate a video game baseball game.
Hats off to Baseball Stars for the original NES, one of the greatest video games ever. Yeah, last thing about video games, like, and I'm sure it's just because I grew up with it, but like, the newer games give you so many options that it's like, it's too much. I like the simplicity of not having that much to choose from in an arcade game.
Understandable. So for the people listening who don't know, because a lot of people listening, I would assume, know you just as a filmmaker and, you know, that you do make music. But for those who don't know, you make a living off of the music. And do you remember a day that you realized you could quit your day job and just live off music? Or was it like a goal you were consciously like waiting till you got to so you could leave your day job and just live off of music?
So, I mean, I always wanted to be a full-time musician, and I was working, you know, even before iTunes existed, with those albums I made with Tom, I would make copies of them and just leave them in libraries, leave them on park benches. I would go to the post office all the time and just mail CDs to random addresses that I found on the internet, coffee shops, bookstores. I Googled "send me free stuff" in quotes and found a bunch of like blogs that included people's personal addresses. And so I would just send things out just because I was like, I just gotta get it out there. You know, 9 out of 10 of these are gonna end up in the trash, but who knows, you know? And a few people over the course of time would reach out, send an email, or even mail back something as a thank you, and so that was good. The point being, I was very focused on trying. I was like, the world needs to hear this. And then in 07, I noticed that the weirdest Mos Haven songs were the most likely to make money. And so I took a little bit of time thinking about it, you know, talking to people about it and being like, you know, I think if I just churned out a lot of weird, unique, specific songs, that could be my job. And even then I knew, I was like, it's going to take a very long time. And what I'd say was, I'm going to give it 5 years. And then if it hasn't worked, I'm going to give it 5 years. That was my plan. And 5 years in, I was still working my day job, but I mean, I was making almost the same, as much money from music as I was making from my day job. And I was like, okay, this is good. My day job doesn't pay very well, but I only had to work 3 days a week anyway. Put them together, that's at least somewhat respectable salary. And then it kept growing. And basically my cutoff line was like, if I'm making twice as much as I need to live, then I'm ready to quit the day job. Because you never know. You never know if it's going to go back, you know? And so I'm like, all right, it could go down, but it probably won't go down by 50%. So that was 2017, and I'm still going.
Yeah, I don't see you having like a big scandal that causes the bottom to fall out. I don't
know. Who knows?
You mentioned your salary in the Times article, which has gone up substantially since you last reported it. What are the songs now that are like, is there a base number of songs that contribute most of that?
I mean, it kind of fluctuates a little bit. You know, just this week, the Solar Eclipse song had a heck of a good week.
Oh, yeah.
Which was pretty cool. Tons of Instagram posts. In fact, the TSA did an Instagram post that used my Solar Eclipse song, which was very funny to see. And I get paid for when they're used on Instagram, so that's cool. And I mean, there's certain favorites. Mothman is a perennial hit. Pooping My Fingernails, of course, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, and I've not talked about how much I earned, you know, for the last several years. But then when this New York Times thing was potentially happening, I was like, hey, I'll tell you what I make if that makes you more likely to want to write about it. And it did. And So yeah, if you want to know what I make for music, read the New York Times article about me.
Because I was curious if, you know, there's some rule that songs that get under a certain number of plays won't get any royalties. And I guess I was curious if that had any impact.
So I think it'll hurt a little bit, you know, but there's like a 80-20 rule to life, it seems, where like 20% of your work earns 80% of your reward, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the top 20% of my songs are earning 80% of my income, and those ones are way over the threshold in order to make money. And I mean, I have thousands of songs that earn like less than a dime a year, you know? And so I'll be losing out on those dimes, I guess. But luckily they don't add up to too much. And hopefully I can also stay ahead of it too, you know, like this, with this article and whatnot, like maybe that'll, make me that much more popular that I won't even feel any ill effects from it.
You have a lot of songs about people. That's an understatement, is a lot. What's like the most impressive person who has heard the song dedicated to them and reached out to you about it?
Well, there's no one more impressive than Kris Jenner, right?
I thought you were going to glad hand and say Toronto's own Will Sloan.
Sorry. Will, come on. Kris Jenner, yeah. Please. Yeah. Well,
is
Kris
mine
Jenner
one of those songs that is being, the royalties are being eliminated?
Whatever you earn, yeah.
I'm not making any money off Will Sloan now that Spotify has that new rule. I should add, also, it's only Spotify that has this rule, and I make more money off Amazon Music than I do off Spotify. And then there's YouTube and Facebook, Instagram, Apple Music, etc. So that's that. So yeah, Kris Jenner made a video on TikTok of her and her daughter dancing to my song about them, and that got viewed 30 million times on TikTok, which was amazing. And then it was cool when Dennis Dugan, director, he called me, and I totally we have family friends, the Dugans, that I've known since I was a kid. And I thought it was a member of that family for the first 30 seconds of the phone call. And it wasn't that long a phone call. And so by the time I hung up, I was like, he directed Saving Silverman. I should have
He directed
said
Grown-Ups 2, for God's sake. One of our favorite movies on this podcast.
Well, okay. Can I just say, Saving Silverman is incredibly hilarious. It is so good. I can't say enough good things about it.
I got to go back to that one. I haven't watched that one since a TBS viewing in my early days of youth. I definitely got to go back to that one.
It's easy to write it off as just another Jason Biggs ridiculous like rom-com, but like it is just over the top, just perfectly over the top comedy. Check it out.
I like my Jason Biggs movies more anything else style, you know.
I'm glad you said it, cuz I was going to if not.
Someone I mean, I'm a Woody apologist. I'm a late Woody apologist.
Oh yeah,
but I can't get my head around that movie. There's just something about the rhythm, even the rhythm of the editing. Just it feels stilted in a weird way. But I'll defend plenty of late Woody movies. Even the Joaquin Phoenix. I won't defend that one. I haven't even gotten through that one. Yeah, but Wonder Wheel. Cafe Society, the Joaquin Phoenix movie.
Yeah.
He had a good little run in the mid-2010s.
I liked Cafe Society. I'll always have an immediate nostalgia for that theatrical viewing opening day. Matt, thank you so much for joining us here. Before we let you go, I want to do a very quick rapid-fire round. I'm going to say the name of an artist from the world of either music or movies. And I want you to immediately say your favorite album or movie by this person. Is that clear enough?
I'm ready. All right.
Woody Allen.
Stardust Memories.
Neil Young.
Cortez the Killer.
Oh, great choice. Bob Dylan.
Shot of Love.
Wow.
The Kinks.
Strangers.
Albert Brooks.
Lost in America.
And finally, Olivia Rodrigo.
Bad Idea, right?
That's a great choice. Great choice, Matt. Matt, thank you so much for joining us on Extended Clip. Will, thank you so much for joining us on Extended Clip. I think this was a very fun discussion, and I hope all of you listening at home enjoyed it as well. You can sign up at patreon.com/extended_clip. There's a link in the description. You sign up, you pay $5 a month, you get an extra episode every single week. The most recent one was on Paul Verhoeven's L, which we have claimed as a modern classic. Matt, anything right now that you want the people to check out? What are you pushing people on right now the most? The movie, the music, besides the New York Times article?
Yeah. You know, last year, my band, The Big Heist, we put out five albums in a row, one per week, called The 50. And boy, it came and went with very little fanfare, even within my realm of things. And it's time for people to rediscover, or frankly, just discover The 50 for the first time. Start with the album Perfect Crime by The Big Heist and be amazed that just... four guys who have a lot of other things to do still manage to churn out this masterpiece.
Matt, how about Moturn on Moturn 2 in a few years?
Oh, every time the phone rings, I'm like, is this the call that they're ready to start the next book? You know I'm there. The thing is, no matter what, when you do it, it's going to go out of date quickly because we're not stopping.
It kind of blows my mind that we wrote that book before Magic Spot, before Heard She Got Married, before any of those movies. Like
it'll be seven movies ago by the end of this year.
Moturn on Moturn. Some people say the 21st century's answer to Robert Bresson's Notes on the Cinematograph. Go check that out if you haven't already. All right, goodbye, everybody.
Jonathan Richman, you are my inspiration. Whenever I make music, I think I want to make music as good as the music that Jonathan Richman makes. Jonathan Richman, you used to be in a proto-punk band or something like that. And then Jonathan Richman, you saw the light and realized that the meaning of life was to make nice music that was easier on the ears and just as groundbreaking and just as wonderful. And you like to sing about painters, and you like to sing about simple basic things in life, in the wonder of looking at life with wide eyes. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You are my inspiration. Yes, you are.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.